the man opposite me. He will be my final... No, no, no. There will be studio guests tomorrow, but he's my final regular guest in the studio, and he's normally not in the studio. Normally, he's somewhere in the Wop Wops. He's our forest correspondent, Dean Bajant-Mercer. Kia ora, Dean. Welcome back tonight.
Kia ora. Good evening, Brian.
Dean, the first thing that struck me is on your side of the desk, all these notes. I think you always got notes like that. You copious notes before we talk.
Yeah. I have to do a lot of swatting. Some people accuse me of having verbal diarrhea, but you know, I still like to try and keep on track.
But what happens? Because often you give the impression, Dean, that you're speaking to me outdoors, in the forest, in the trees. I mean, next to the trees, not up in the trees. But what happens when the wind blows? What happens to your notes?
Well, it just depends on the time of year. I might be sitting on a stool on the top of a small hill looking across the forest.
Yes, well, I'm sure you said once to me that you had to go wandering quite a long way to get decent phone reception.
Oh, yeah, there was a bit of a drama. What?
is it better now, is it?
It depends on the
weather.
Have
you got broadband?
No. I'm out in the sticks. If it's windy, it can cut out. Jesse Mulligan found that out the hard way once.
Oh, really? Did he? Oh, dear. That must have freaked him out and the producers as well.
Caught short.
Now, anyway, these notes. Lowland forest, swamp forest. Because it's precious, because we've built on it. We chopped it down and built on it, right?
Oh, yeah, well, that and...
How's that for a
that
summary?
And more. That and
right,
more.
Okay.
I've really been getting into the nitty-gritty of it today. Kahikatea, like one of our most iconic trees. I mean, lots of people have heard the word. A lot of people, though, can't even recognise one when they see one. Mm. You have male and female kahikatea. They're quite different.
In shape?
No, mainly in their sexual organs. As we say. And so the boys are about to drop their pollen in the next few months. And so they get these little wee cones on them that go a very light yellow colour, and the wind takes them off. And I've seen these trees on when it's been still for a long time in Auckland, which you'll never see in Wellington, obviously, a pulse of wind and a branch shake. And the pollen drifts off in the same shape as the branch. And so that's how the male trees end up pollinating the female trees.
My goodness.
They're amazing. But they're our tallest native trees.
Yes. And I often associate the younger kahikatea with quite a straight, almost pine. They have a bit more of a pine look. They go up quite straight and they have a slight steeply sided cone to them.
They look like an upside down ice cream cone for their middle age. But they actually have four stages of life.
Do they?
The first stage only lasts for a few centimetres. Then the second one is a very messy, straggly teenager. And almost looks dead. And then that gives way to this very tidy upside down ice cream cone shape that lasts for, which is really a teenage phase as well. It lasts for, you know, 100 years or 200 years or whatever.
Right.
And then when they're actually mature, they're very, very tall and gangly, and their trunks are straight, and they can go up a huge kind of height, at least 10 stories high. Mm. And then they've kind of got a little lollipop of foliage at the top.
Up to 100 metres or maybe a little bit less?
Up to 50 metres.
50 metres, okay.
And that's 16 and a half stories.
Right, okay.
That's pretty impressive.
Aren't the trunks, don't they buttress a bit at the bottom sometimes?
They do. They fan out. And it's been... down in Westland, if you go through there, you know the road is cut through these amazing kahikatea forests. Mm. And I always wondered how they didn't fall over. And I've been reading that book, Hidden Life of Trees, which is actually written by a German guy, Peter Wallenbin. And he was talking about how trees can fuse their roots. And I saw evidence of
this. What, two different trees?
Different trees, same species.
Right. And their roots under the ground will fuse together.
Yeah. Mm. And so I saw in the wetland that I look after up at Ōtangaroa in the north, a kahikatea that had been cut down a long time ago, and it was calloused at the top, but still alive. And so the trunk was still alive with fluids going up and down it, but it was joined on.
That was Dean banging his microphone, because we've discovered now that Dean also waves his arms around quite a lot when he's talking.
Yes.
Of course he would.
I'm a gesticulator.
So you're saying the trunk was alive?
The trees,
like a headless chook?
Yeah. Sort of. It's yeah, the trunk of the tree, the butt, the stump of the tree was still alive. There was still sap flowing in it, and it was joined to other kahikatea trees around it. This has been discovered in other parts of the world. I've also seen it was Tōtara. So this is part of the mechanism, I think, for them to be able to be so tall and not be toppled so easily.
Because those roots are hanging on to each other.
They're kind of a big fused mat network. But then, of course, because they're in marshy areas, swampy areas. So, you know, areas, flat areas of the country, like the Manawatu, Canterbury Plains, all these areas, they had great big rivers that were snaking. And we know about braided rivers moving, but it was much more than that, because these huge trees would be inundated with water when the floods come. You know, the seasons change and then we get the wet periods. The floods, they didn't gush as they did now. The rivers rose and they moved across the land. They moved into those little dips and ponds where the river had once cut in and joined all these areas together and allowed fish to move between them.
And I'm thinking now, because I talked a lot at the start about, well, yes, the flat country, we tended to build on it, but I've forgotten the other thing we've done to a lot of flat country. We drained it so we could farm it.
We drained it and we constrained it.
And that's where the trees also went, yeah.
And so when the waters were allowed to go as wide as they could, they also took nutrients and sediment with them, dust from further up the catchment. And you can, and I've seen this at Ngamanu Sanctuary, which is just north of Wellington here on the Kapiti Coast, after a flood. And you can see the level of the flood on the trees because there's all the silt on them. And that happened every year. These forests were being fertilised by the actual, the flooding events. And so as we have constrained rivers and pulled them in after we'd killed the forests.
Into a channel with a stop bank on either side.
And built up as close as we can to it, or farmed up as close. Then that fertility is being pushed out to sea. And so strangely enough, the farming practices on those areas that have cleared, we now bring fertiliser from other parts of the world, like Western Sahara and elsewhere. So that all sorts of chains of natural cycles were broken.
Of course, to put stand up a little bit for the farmers, it's possibly difficult to grow grass or any kind of crop if you're getting flooded every 6 months or a year or so.
It's not necessarily what I'm suggesting, Brian, but you make a fine point there. Perhaps the question is the right place to do things, and maybe in this time of a changing climate, we need to give rivers back the room and make room for rivers, because nature is boss in the end. It will take it back one way or another. And as we're looking at adaptation and clawing our way back from the coastlines, we also need to think about doing a similar thing with rivers, or else nature will make up our minds for us.
Tell me, and I'm talking to our forest correspondent, Dean Badgett-Mercer from Forest and Bird. He's not in Northland at the moment. He's in the studio with me, and he's talking about swamp forests, lowland forests. Tell me about the wetland that you yourself have restored.
It's not a huge area, but I went and collected seed of flax a number of years ago and grew them at my flat in Auckland. These little wee things came up, and then I potted them up and then got them up to the north, and I moved the electric fence back bit by bit and took the swamp back from the cattle. And now there's hundreds and hundreds of flax. Every 3 years, they have a very heavy mast year, a very heavy seeding year. And my prediction is that this coming summer, we're going to have a mast.
Right.
Because it's the third year since before last year.
Just for the flax, or do you think
just for flax. Right. Other things have other cycles. And so I was down there with a friend, Karen Field, a few weeks ago, and I thought, on dusk, what would happen if I just played a call of a poo-whittle, that is the spotless crake, which was a common bird all throughout these lowland areas in the country. What would happen if I played this bird call? Because I suspected they were in the wetland. So it's somewhat like this. Well, the producer is looking frantic.
Find it. No, he's looking rather worried right now.
He's probably been mucking around trying to get all these sounds right.
This is in search of the spotless crake.
Here we go.
What is that?
Did you hear that? That was crazy.
Can we play that again, please, mad. Jeremy? I want to hear that again. I mean, the chip, chip, chip.
Yeah.
That's sort of typical.
That little chippy thing.
That sounded like something you'd hear on Jurassic Park, that second bit.
Yeah. You know, it's loud.
Baby nasty dinosaur.
Yep.
Yeah, let's see if we can get it going again.
Nearly jumped out of my skin.
Yeah. Yes, here it comes. What's that humming in the background, by the way? Is that your generator, Dean?
This isn't my recording.
Wow.
Isn't that stunning?
I've never heard this bird song before. Admittedly, I don't hear Morning Report much these days on account of the hours that I work, but I haven't heard this. No, it's the Pūweto.
Pūweto?
Or the spotless.
Crake.
Crake. Crake. I'm struggling with that word. I end up saying quake, and I don't want to. But it's a, by the way, I'll put a little illustration up on the Facebook page, Knights and RNZ National. You want to see what that little ditty looks like.
Like little miniature pūkeko.
Yes, but they're rounder. They're plumper. You know, the pūkeko are a little bit sort of stretched, but it's quite a ball.
And they're not show-off strident things like pūkeko. Nice blue, secretive.
Nice blue plumage, though.
Indeed. Yeah.
So you never see them?
No, I've never seen one, but they're
How
around.
How close were you to the one that was making that noise?
I don't know, 5 or 6 metres.
Right.
5 or 6 metres.
Really quite loud.
It's a lot louder.
So how many are there? There are quite a few?
Oh, I don't know. It was just a wild experiment.
Right. So you played a bit of a recording and that it answered back.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe it was thought
well
there
done.
Was another one in the territory.
Mm.
So this is that strange sound that you heard would have been a really common sound for people even, 200 years ago. It was one of the more common birds in these wetlands. And so you had these floods, as I was saying. It would allow little fish to move around. It would allow eel migrations. And these birds, you'd have the birds on the bottom of the forest, the flightless ones, or the waders going around eating little fish like white bait as they moved around. And then in the tops of the forests, you would have huge flocks of kereru and kaka and those kinds of things, which were moving all the seeds around.
Dean, what might you suggest if you think it's time to maybe let those rivers give them room again, as you said, because there's a lot of demand for land. It's a scarce resource. How might we do that? How might, say, a farmer who has a river running through the farm might make some room for that river and still be able to farm?
Well,
make a living from farming.
The river in the end will be boss, as I've mentioned, but there is a way, a future way of doing this, and the future's not far away in this respect in terms of replanting and getting money for the carbon that's sunk by restoring native habitats.
We've spoken about this before.
We have, but the other massive benefit is, as we've constrained rivers and made them go fast and in a straighter line as possible, When the water goes up and it hits flax and kahikatea and things like that, it slows the water down. It disperses the energy and it carries that fertility with it. And so we've gone too far extreme in one direction. We need to pull it back in the other direction.
Are you saying downstream from a swamp you might have more protection from a flooded river because the river might not be so constrained? Of course, The less room there is in the pipe, the higher the pressure in the hose coming out the end of the hose.
Mm. I've seen this with the big floods up north. I had this, back in 2007, there was a 150-year event, and I just had a driveway put in off across this wetland, and it got ripped out. It was such a powerful flood. And then the wetland that I mentioned before, I planted that all the way upstream. And so when we had powerful floods the next time, instead of the speed, the water hit the flax and it had no choice but go up slowly and go down slowly. And so it didn't have as much damaging effect.
In other words, now, again, I'm looking at this perhaps from the human point of view. That area now, you're going to have to accept that's going to flood and you give it over to the river, the stream. So there's some loss of land there. Mm-hmm. But there's a benefit downstream, a benefit not in terms of structures near the river, and a benefit maybe in terms of also the cleanliness of the water downstream.
All of those things.
Yeah.
And carbon credits too.
Yes. So there's the trade-off, plus more of those weird noises.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
From the Pūweto, the spotless crake. I can't get that word out. I know it's not quite right, but I'm obsessed now, so I'm going to keep on trying. Dean, how much do you know? How much we have left of what would have been there before Pākehā arrived?
In terms of Kahikatea forest,
yeah.
Well, lowland's different from Kahikatea because it depends what country you're in. But the Kahikatea floodplain forest, there's less than 2% left. And, of course, the last 2% left that are most healthy are miles away from where people live because people tend to do terrible things to them. And they are between Fox Glacier down to Haast.
Mm.
And they're in an area that's being considered at the moment in terms of the stewardship land review. And so we are hoping that the government adds them to national parks or give them appropriate protection because at the moment they're just kind of sitting there as dock land. And previous ministers have said, oh, it's just kind of our scuzzy land, all of that. A bit of gorse here and there, that stewardship land, the million hectares out there. Maybe we can do something with it, like get some mining happening or whatever. But this is the last 2% of Kahikatea forest. And so we need to really look after it, that last stuff on the in Westland.
What about some of the resources that some people get from those rivers? I'm thinking about tuna, eel, or the species of whitebait. You know, whitebait are under pressure, and it's a habitat thing more than anything else, isn't it, Dean?
Well, if you don't have the habitat, you can't have the whitebait. The more habitat we have around rivers, restoring them so that there's shade, so that there's those kind of big sedges that have their leaves dropping in to the rivers where the inanga lay their eggs in the flood times, the more of that we have, the more we'll have the cycle of those inanga, the whitebait species, returning up the rivers.
How did your wetland cope in the last flood event? Because there was another big one. It's knocked out several big roads around your part of the world.
It did, not far away. And that is the benefit in terms of keeping the land together, slowing down the speed of the water. It was a non-event almost. And it was incredible to look at the colour of the water. I've done this before during Cyclone Wilma. The water coming into the wetland and the water going out the downhill side, it's almost clear. And so all of that murkiness, the disgustingness you see in rivers throughout the country, that the natural filtration devices, if we put things back, it cleans our rivers, as you'd mentioned before. It really works. It's amazing.
Dean, it's been lovely having you in, and I think we should go out, if we can, with the Pūweto again. I think that's a good way of saying goodbye. What else are you doing in Wellington, by the way? I mean, there's not so much Kahikatea around here, although there is some up the road.
Oh, I'm just enjoying myself. With COVID and stuff, I've been by myself far too much, so I'm having a good old social time.
Dean, I'm glad you wanted to spend some of your social time with us here on Nights.
Marvellous.
That's Dean Bagent-Mercer, our forest correspondent. And here, I think, is a little bit more ahead of the next song, which will be followed by Raymond Sangapolotelli talking about things south side of the Tamaki and north of the Bombay. Here is a little bit more of the spotless crake.